Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this next half-hour segment, we're going to continue with a discussion of the political implications of the UFO phenomenon and the ET myth, because there is abundant evidence, and we'll provide more evidence in this broadcast, more of that type of evidence in this broadcast, that UFOs are real, that is to say circular or otherwise unconventionally shaped aircraft flying in the Earth's atmosphere are real. But the evidence suggests very strongly that those unconventionally shaped and circularly shaped flying machines come from Earth, not from outer space, and that in all probability the same elements within earthly, altogether terrestrial, national security establishments that have developed these extraordinary flying machines are also developing the myth that those flying machines come from outer space, and that we're in touch with other beings from a superior civilization, and that ultimately we should turn over the governance of our human affairs to those superior beings, or those allegedly superior beings, from an allegedly superior civilization. In other segments, including the last half-hour segment, we discussed the fascistic and totalitarian overtones of many of the cults and philosophies espoused by some of these alleged extraterrestrial contactee cults, including the Raelian movement of Claude Vorion, which is now going to engage in human cloning. The reason why I believe the UFO phenomenon and the ET myth is worthy of study in a political context was exemplified by an article that appeared on the front page of the New York Times on June 14th of 1997 that I discussed in the last half-hour segment. In that article, again, a front-page story on the New York Times of June 14th, 1997, a Gallup poll, or the results of a Gallup poll, are related, which find that 42% of college graduates, 42%, feel we've been visited by flying saucers from outer space. That, in and of itself, makes the UFO phenomenon worthy of study from a political standpoint, because in all probability, those 42% are believing in a myth and one that appears to be propagated for altogether unsavory purposes. We're going to take a look once again at the propagation of the myth of ETs and the almost certainty that circular flying machines of terrestrial origin are real. Again, UFOs appear to be real, ETs are the myth. This is not to say that there might not be intelligent life on some other planet, someplace. There's no evidence, no concrete evidence that has been developed of that so far. There's damn little evidence of intelligent life on this planet. However, there is no concrete evidence whatsoever that we've ever been visited by any creature from outer space. On the contrary, there's a lot of evidence that that myth has been deliberately created by creatures from this planet with altogether unsavory intent. Once again, let's take a look at a couple of items from a book that I've quoted a great deal on this subject in the past. That book is entitled Revelations. It's subtitled Alien Contact and Human Deception. Revelations was authored by Jacques Vallée, and the book was published in soft cover by Ballantine Books, copyright 1991. The ISBN number is 0-345-37566-1. And in ruminating about the propagation of the ET myth, Vallée discusses those intelligence operatives and apparent government informants who have been propagating that myth. He writes of them saying, "The fact that all their training, all their alleged documents, from MJ-12 to Grudge Report 13, all their vaunted references come directly from the lie, steal, and cheat department of the most disreputable part of the military establishment, should not give us pause for thought. True, these are the same folks who, in an earlier era, brought us the horrors of Mind Control, COINTELPRO, and MK-Ultra, Watergate, and Iran-Contra. They remind us of the psychological warfare experts who sat on the board of NICAP and spied on civilian UFO research groups." And in addition to that, Vallée writes, skipping down, "Another aspect many researchers of this field, with a few courageous and notable exceptions, have studiously ignored, is the link between the more eager proponents of imminent extraterrestrial contact and the American extreme right. The American extreme right and the most unsavory aspects of or elements of our own national security establishment are implicated directly in yet another example of the ET myth." Quoting now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, June 5th of 1997. The following is an article, a New York Times story. It's datelined Washington. It's headlined, "Thurman Shrinks from Book on Aliens." Subtitled, "He wrote the foreword for author friend." Senator Strom Thurmond, Republican of South Carolina, tried to distance himself from a book for which he wrote the foreword, whose author contends that the nation's military and industrial power largely derived from a crashed alien spaceship. The Day After Roswell, published by Pocket Books, says that the government found an alien craft that had crashed in the desert near Roswell, New Mexico, in July of 1947, and set up a program to glean its secrets, including things like lasers, computer chips, and fiber optics. The government clandestinely fed the alien technology to the military and industry, the book says, while engaging in a wide conspiracy to keep the existence of the aliens from the American public. The book might be dismissed as part of a genre making similar wild claims about the Roswell incident, which the government says involved nothing more unusual than a crashed weather balloon, except for author Philip J. Corso's military background, his claimed role in the endeavor, and Thurman's praise of the author in the foreword. By the way, I would note that Senator Strom Thurmond is chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, one of the fixtures of the American legislative far right, and a very, very powerful political figure. Continuing, Thurmond, chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, writes in the foreword that Corso worked for him as an aide after leaving the Army and praises him as a person of integrity who served his country well. Quote, "He has many interesting stories to share with individuals interested in military history, espionage, and the workings of our government," unquote, Thurmond wrote. But he made no mention of the book's central thesis of inadvertent aid to the United States by space aliens. In a statement released yesterday, Thurmond said that he agreed to provide the foreword on the understanding that the book was autobiographical and that he regretted that it appeared to bolster assertions of a government conspiracy and cover-up. Corso says that while he was at the Pentagon, he spearheaded an Army project that secretly planted the alien technologies throughout the economy and military, mainly to build up U.S. strength to fight an inevitable war against alien invaders. Well, we're going to find out a little more about the background of Philip J. Corso right now. We're going to turn for some information about Corso to a book entitled The Man Who Knew Too Much. That book is authored by Dick Russell, R-U-S-S-E-L-L. It's arguably the most comprehensive and one of the very best books about the assassination of President Kennedy. The book was published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff Publishers. It's copyright 1992. The ISBN number is 0-88184-900-6. Now, we come across Philip Corso in the discussion of some of the political connections of Charles Willoughby. Charles Willoughby was a major general in the United States Army. His name at birth was Karl Adolf von Zschäpe und Wiedenbach. He was a German-born fascist, and he was a doctrinaire fascist whose idol was Francisco Franco. And Willoughby was very close to fascist elements that survived the downfall of Nazi Germany, very close to Francisco Franco, the former fascist dictator of Spain. He also was in charge of all military intelligence for Douglas MacArthur from 1939 through 1950. Willoughby was one of the most important military intelligence officers of that period and also had connections with numerous fascists and far-right elements. Among Willoughby's connections was to an organization called the Szyksyni Knights of Malta. That's a far-right sect, not to be confused with the Knights of Malta or the Sovereign Military Order of Malta. That is a Vatican order which itself has many interesting and very powerful and far-right-wing connections. Dick Russell writes of Charles Willoughby, the Szyksyni Knights of Malta, and Philip J. Corso as follows in the book The Man Who Knew Too Much. In the United States, both before and after his autumn European sojourn, this, by the way, is the autumn of 1963, Willoughby was in the midst of a steady correspondence with Colonel Charles Tureau Pichel, P-I-C-H-E-L. 30 years earlier, when Hitler first came to power in Germany, Pichel had written the Führer's close associate Ernst Hamstengel requesting that he, Pichel, be appointed official American liaison to Hitler. In 1963, Pichel was Grand Chancellor of a mysterious sect called the Sovereign Order of St. John of Jerusalem, also known as the Szyksyni Knights, after the Pennsylvania town where Pichel was based. By the way, that's capital S-H-I-C-K-S-H-I-N-N-Y, one word. Continuing. Pichel's group claimed to be legitimate Knights of Malta, a Catholic order dating back to the Crusades. During the French Revolution, when Napoleon occupied Malta, the existing knights scattered. One group was reconstituted later under the sovereignty of the Vatican. Another sought sanctuary under Tsar Paul I in Russia, remaining there until the Russian Revolution of 1917, when they resettled once more in white Russian communities in America and Europe. Many came to the sleepy Pennsylvania town of Szyksyni. It is not clear from Willoughby's papers just how he happened to hook up with Bushell, but by September of 1963, he had become the order's, quote, security general, unquote. As he wrote to Bushell, "I shall be honored to be of service. I am familiar with the tradition and ethical purposes of your order," unquote. He said he anticipated contributing his, quote, specialized knowledge and experience in the field of intelligence, counterintelligence, and security surveillance, unquote. For a time, he even merged his Foreign Intelligence Digest into the Knight's own publication. On his autumn 1963 trip, he informed Bushell that he would see about gaining recognition for the order from Generalissimo Franco in Madrid. Willoughby was in auspicious company, for the Shikshini Knights had an, quote, armed services committee, unquote, that in 1963 read like a who's who of retired military men at the extremist fringe. All these, quote, knights, unquote, had been, again quoting, singled out for their brilliant and outstanding careers as soldiers of Christ and advocates of a free world, unquote. Besides Willoughby, they included a number of other members of MacArthur's old team, Brigadier General Bonner Fellers, Lieutenant General Pedro del Valle, Marine General Lemuel Shepherd, British Admiral Sir Barry Domville, D-O-M-V-I-L-L-E, jailed in England during World War II as a Nazi agent, was also on the list. So was Colonel Philip J. Corso, C-O-R-S-O, a 20-year Army intelligence career man until his retirement in August of 1963. He had been the Military Operations Coordinating Board's delegate to the CIA group planning the 1954 Guatemalan coup. In 1956, Corso had sought to reactivate 50 surviving garrisons of Eastern European paramilitary units still hanging on in West Germany and tied to the Galen spy network. When his Volunteer Freedom Corps, dedicated to rolling back communism, was scuttled as too radical by the Eisenhower administration, Corso attributed the defeat to, quote, lies by our liberal darlings, unquote. A staunch foe of what he considered a laissez-faire CIA, Corso testified before Congress on, quote, military muzzling, unquote, after General Walker was kicked out of West Germany in 1961. Upon leaving Army intelligence, Corso went to work in 1963 as a, quote, research assistant, unquote, for segregationist Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina. And after the Kennedy assassination, Corso was among the first to spread rumors hinting that Oswald was tied to a communist ring inside the CIA and doubling as an informant for the FBI. So again, note this is the same Philip J. Corso, who says that our government is working with space aliens and that he had first-hand knowledge of this. He was also claiming that Lee Harvey Oswald killed Kennedy and that Oswald was a communist. The same Philip J. Corso was working with Eastern European military groups that were associated with the Reinhard Galen spy outfit. Reinhard Galen was Hitler's intelligence chief for the Eastern Front in World War II, and also then jumped to the CIA and later to NATO and finally the Federal Republic of Germany with his organization, Hitler's Eastern Front spy outfit, essentially intact from the World War II period. I've discussed that in numerous broadcasts, and I've discussed the aforementioned Charles Willoughby in RFA program number 10, available from Spitfire. One of the reasons that I continue to focus on the UFO phenomenon and the ET myth is that, again, with many people believing, with 42% of college graduates, according to a recent Gallup poll, believing that we've been visited by space aliens, and again, with the entire dialogue on UFOs having been dichotomized, unfortunately, into two extremes. Either it's all BS, it's all, you know, weather balloons, or the planet Venus on a bright night, or else it's space aliens from Uranus. There's no middle ground, namely that UFOs might be real, but that they don't come from outer space. In a recent pair of half-hour segments, I excerpted a lecture entitled The Political Implications of the UFO Phenomenon and the ET Myth, in which I discussed indications that the first circular flying machines in the Earth's atmosphere derived from German anti-aircraft devices that were deployed in the closing phases of World War II. Again, the so-called Foo Fighters, or Krautballs, as American airmen dubbed them, appear to have been real, and they did not come from outer space, but rather from the R&D laboratories of Nazi Germany during the closing stages of World War II. An interesting perspective on that information, and also on the Roswell incident, was presented in an article that was the cover story of Popular Mechanics for July of 1997. Again, this is the cover story for Popular Mechanics from July of 1997. Their website, by the way, is http://popularmechanics1word.com. Again, that's http://popularmechanics1word.com. popularmechanicsoneword.com. And again, this is the cover story for the July 1997 issue of Popular Mechanics. The story is entitled Roswell Plus 50, subtitled 50 Years Ago, Something Crashed in the Desert. New evidence points to two equally startling conclusions. The article is by Jim Wilson, the science and technology editor of Popular Mechanics. Early on in the article, but skipping a little bit past the beginning, the author writes as follows. Suspecting there was more to the Roswell story, Popular Mechanics undertook its own investigation to learn if anything new had emerged in this 50-year-old techno-mystery. After interviewing witnesses who had seen and handled crash site debris, and reviewing documents that were still classified when the GAO undertook its investigation, we have concluded that there really was a crashed disk, dead bodies, and a secret that could have been politically deadly to Presidents Harry S. Truman and Dwight D. Eisenhower. But I would indicate, anticipating the latter part of the article, there was a secret, but it wasn't that UFOs came from outer space, it's that they came from right here on Earth. Continuing. In 1947, the Roswell Army Airfield, or RAAF, was home to America's most elite air unit, the nuclear weapon-equipped 509th Bomb Group. And during the first week of July, nearly everyone on base and off was at a heightened state of alert. Since mid-May, Americans had been in the grips of what historians would later call the great UFO craze of 1947. By some counts, as many as 800 sightings of strange objects were reported. At the bars, lunch counters, and dinner tables in Roswell, airmen retold stories of mysterious, quote, krautballs, unquote, and, quote, Foo Fighters, unquote, that had played tag with bombers and fighters as they flew missions over Europe and the Pacific. There is one more important but often overlooked historic fact to keep in mind. In the years immediately after the war, the term, quote, flying disc, unquote, did not necessarily mean a flying machine from another planet. That is a terribly important detail, and one that figures prominently in the concluding and decisive part of this vitally important article. After discussing some allegations by a military former intelligence officer named Kaufman, the author writes as follows in a section entitled, tellingly, The German Connection. I was all but ready to trash Kaufman's story when a nearly foot-thick package of documents obtained via Freedom of Information Act requests arrived on my desk. As I read their badly photocopied pages, I came to realize that my judgment of Kaufman's story might have been overly hasty. The more I read, the more credible Kaufman's tale, except for his conclusion about extraterrestrials, became. The most surprising information was contained in a declassified Air Force briefing paper entitled Report on Project Silverbug. It was prepared by the Joint Air Technical Intelligence Center at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1955. It had two purposes. The first was to update civilian and military intelligence experts on technical issues related to so-called flying saucers. Its second goal was to enlist the help of the FBI, CIA, and intelligence units within the State Department in determining if the Soviets were pursuing similar aircraft designs. To provide the intelligence community with technical background, the report described several ongoing U.S. saucer projects. Sketches of two vehicles described in the report appear on this page and on page 53. Configured as classic UFOs, these craft exhibited flight specifications that were nothing short of phenomenal, even by today's standards. The largest weighed 26,000 pounds and was powered by jet engines that could lift it to an altitude of 36,900 feet, as high as today's airliners fly, in about 1 minute 45 seconds. The operating ceiling of these amazing craft was 80,600 feet. Their cruise speed was an astounding Mach 3.48. And again, this is information concerning Air Force projects that were underway in the late 1940s, and these were not anything from outer space. Again, continuing. Using keywords and technical descriptions in the Silverbug report, Popular Mechanics was able to trace the origin of these remarkable aircraft to Germany. And here, in half-century-old intelligence files stamped secret, we learned that the U.S. government had mounted a massive search for engineers and scientists who would work in the so-called German saucer project. Contrary to UFO literature, which claims the Germans were attempting to reverse engineer a crashed alien vehicle of their own, these documents show a more practical reason for interest in saucers. They could take off without runways. Months of around-the-clock bombing by the Allies had reduced German runways to rubble. The Third Reich's only hope of using its newly perfected jet engine propulsion system to regain air superiority would be to install it in a vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. The documents also tell of Army intelligence officers combing Europe for two brothers, Walter and Reimar Horten, H-O-R-T-E-N. Trained as pilots and engineers, they had close connections to the Reich's high command. The information provided to Army intelligence said they were believed to have persuaded German leaders to construct a fleet of saucer-shaped bombers. U.S. military historians acknowledge that the Horten brothers built and flew prototypes of circular and flying wing aircraft. But they dismissed these craft as aeronautical curiosities with no military value. Initially, popular mechanics discounted a possible connection between the Horten brothers and Roswell. We began to think differently after we obtained a copy of a long secret field report from an American intelligence officer stationed in Germany. In response for a service-wide request for information about the Horten brothers, he had apparently looked into the most secret military files. There, he discovered, and duly reported to his superiors, that the Horten brothers already had been found. Quote, paperclip records further show that the men were released by the United Kingdom for exploitation and allocated to the U.S. on November 15, 1946, unquote, the officer's report said. Operation Paperclip was the code name for one of the Second World War's most secret and ethically controversial projects. Its mission was to put former Nazi scientists and engineers on the U.S. payroll. The American public knew the secret of Los Alamos weeks after the first atomic bomb exploded. They would not be told of Paperclip until after men landed on the moon, an event made possible by Paperclip rocket scientists. The reason for keeping Paperclip secret was that the laboratories at which many of the former German scientists had worked were also Nazi slave labor and death camps. The fact that the Nazis had technology that American engineers could not duplicate was deemed too harsh a message for a nation that had gone to war for a higher moral purpose. Probing further into the fate of the Horten brothers, popular mechanics learned that just prior to their capture, they had been working on the design for a new generation of circular-shaped, vertical takeoff aircraft with specifications much like those described in the Silverbug report. Other records indicate that, after the war, models of the Horten's designs, possibly constructed by the brothers themselves, were tested in the wind tunnel at Wright Field, now Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. This is the same base to which the wreckage of the Roswell crash was finally transported. The Air Force acknowledges that the Germans were working on a flying disc craft, but says it was inherently unstable. Officials point to the failed Avro flying car built for the Army and a deteriorating plywood Horten wing, both on display in museums. Declassified records obtained by Popular Mechanics in the course of its investigation suggest that these marginally performing craft were, in fact, shills intended to disguise the existence of more formidable flying machines. One of the most potent of these flying discs was developed under a secret program called Project Piwacket. Its objective was to design a 5-foot diameter liquid-fueled missile launch platform to protect U.S. bombers penetrating Soviet airspace. In the end, the military would select conventionally shaped planes and missiles. As for the Horten flying disc that the Reich had hoped would turn the tide of battle, Patton writes to a remarkably similar craft configured to carry, quote, passengers, unquote, would be assigned to the Lockheed Aircraft Company. A cutaway diagram of this unusual craft appears on the top of this page. Despite this information, the possibility that the object that crashed at Roswell was in fact one of the Horten brothers' creations misses the mark on two important details. The craft that Kaufman claims to have helped recover was not round, but, as his sketches showed, a lifting body. Also, he claims there was no fire damage, a virtual impossibility in the crash of a jet-powered aircraft. As our investigation neared its close, Popular Mechanics was alerted to a forthcoming release of documents that may fill in these two missing pieces of the Roswell puzzle. They may also explain two other curiosities. the presence of the crisscrossed radar-deflecting pattern on the bottom of the Roswell craft, and, to the consternation of those who seek an unearthly explanation for Roswell, the origin of the, quote, dead aliens, unquote, who have so often been described as having oriental features. Popular Mechanics has been told that the document scheduled for future release will tell of a Japanese counterpart to Operation Paperclip. One of its purposes was to determine if the Japanese had constructed a suicide-piloted version of the Fugo incendiary bomb. During the Second World War, the Japanese launched these unmanned high-altitude balloons in the hope that they would land in the Pacific Northwest, explode, ignite forest fires, and thereby deprive the war effort of needed lumber. The effort was an obvious failure. The Japanese may have attempted to build a second generation of Fugos that could be guided to targets by suicidal pilots. Popular Mechanics suspects the craft that crashed at Roswell will eventually be identified as either a U.S. attempt to re-engineer a second-generation Fugo or a hybrid craft which uses both Fugo lifting technology and a Horton-inspired lifting body. In either case, Japanese engineers and pilots brought to the U.S. after the war to work on the project could have been the dead, quote, alien, unquote, bodies recovered at the crash site. Also equipped with a rudimentary radar-deflecting underside, such a balloon would have reached stratospheric altitudes as it traveled over Western Europe and been well above the range of the then-existing MiG fighters and missiles, even if it had been detected. It could have carried out both photo reconnaissance and air sampling experiments, similar to those of the Mogul balloon, before gliding back to Earth in friendly territory. 50 years after the fact, the questions about Roswell still ring loud and clear. Our investigation leads us to believe the explanations that require an extraterrestrial presence, while possible, are nevertheless highly implausible. Indeed, whether it was a Japanese component to Project Paperclip, or perhaps the Horton aircraft, perhaps Mr. Kaufman is providing disinformation. Again, the Popular Mechanics issue of July of 1997 provides some very terrestrial explanations for the Roswell incident, those in keeping with other documentation that UFOs are real, but they don't come from outer space. By the way, tip of the hat to a listener who researched this for us, a tip of the hat to another listener who made the connection between the article about Strom Thurmond and Philip Corso and the Corso material in the book, The Man Who Knew Too Much. All of the various archive shows that I've produced, as well as the half-hour segments and the interviews that I've done, are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, Spitfire. They can be contacted at P.O. Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179, that's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. That address again, Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. There's also an email address, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, that's one word, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. That email address again, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E at ix.netcom.com. You can also see a list of and descriptions of all of the various programs available from Spitfire by taking a look at the KFJC website. Point your web browser at www.kfjc.org. Again, www.kfjc.org, and look in the public affairs selection for either Spitfire or Dave Emery. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.